Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
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 He
cha
chitra. Samadhishta,
Samadhishta,
Te cha pitra Samadhishta,
Te cha pitra Samadhishta,
Te cha pitra Samadhishta,
Te cha pitra Samadhishta,
Praja,
Praja,
Sage,
Sage,
Krita,
Krita,
Prata,
Prata,
Praja, Praja, Sage, Krita, Prata,
Praja, Sage, Krita, Prata,
Sage Jita Prata,
Sage Jita Prata,
Techa Pitra Samadhishta,
Techa Pitra Samadhishta,
Praja Sage Jita Prata,
Sage Jita Prata,
Narayana,
Saro,
Jagmu, Narayana,
Saro, Jagmu.
Techa pitra samadhishta,
Techa pitra samadhishta,
Praja sage jita prata,
Praja sage jita prata,
Narayana saro jagmur,
Narayana saro jagmur,
Yatra siddha sapurvajaha,
Yatra siddha sapurvajaha,
Techa pitra samadhishta,
Techa pitra samadhishta,
Praja sage jita prata,
Praja sage
Narayana saro jagmu,
Narayana saro jagmu,
Yatra siddha sapurvajaha,
Yatra siddha sapurvajaha.
Te,
these sons,
the Savalashtras,
Cha,
and
Pitra,
by the Father,
by the Father,
Samadhishta,
Samadhishta,
in order.
Praja Sage,
in increasing progeny,
for population,
Vikavrata, accepted vows, Narayana Shara, the holy lake named Narayana Saras, Jagmu went to Yatra,
Yatra,
where?
Siddha,
perfected.
Sapurvaja,
their older brothers, who had previously gone there. It's interesting that the way this word is presented, Sapurvaja. Sapurva generally means first or the beginning or something like that. So in this sense, it can mean. It's got a double meaning in this sense, because first of all, it's referring to, well, sa means there, so purva, ja means born or progeny. And so purva can mean the first sons or the ones who've done it before. So it's kind of very interesting the way it's essentially, because it's got a double meaning, so that's brought out also in the translation. In accordance with their father's order to beget children, the second group of sons also went to Narayana Saras, the same place where their brothers had previously attained perfection by following the instructions of Narada. Undertaking great vows of austerity, the Savalashtras remained at that holy place, responsibly, in accordance with their father's order. Responsibly, please. In accordance with their father's order.
In accordance with their father's order.
To beget children.
To beget children.
The second group of sons.
The second group of sons.
Also Cyrus.
Also in the Magi Cyrus.
The same place where their brothers had previously attained perfection.
The same place where their brothers had previously attained perfection.
By following the instructions of Narada.
By following the instructions of Narada.
Undertaking great vows of austerity.
Undertaking great vows of austerity.
The Savalashtras remained at that holy place.
The Savalashtras remained at that holy place.
Amazing power, please, isn't it? Purport. Prajapati Daksha sent his second group of sons to the same place where his previous sons had attained perfection. He did not hesitate to send his second group of sons to the same place, although they too might become victims of Narada's instructions. So why didn't he hesitate to do it? Because he, you know, like the first group of sons went there and they got corrupted, and they got contaminated by Narada, and then they went to the path of Narada. Why didn't he hesitate? No thoughts on that?
Who hesitated?
Why didn't he hesitate? Daksha.
Maybe he thought it's so important that the sons were sent to purify themselves for purpose.
It's important, but there's a deeper meaning, especially in Vedic culture. You see, the Vedic culture is very much bound by duty. People do things because it's a duty, even though they don't want to. So he was obviously feeling some reluctance that we've seen in the past, in the previous verses, how he was quite upset about it. But because it was his duty to do whatever he could to see that his sons, you know, were culturally enriched, as you see Prabhupada describes later on the purport, he did not hesitate to do that because it was his duty. And so we see, it's just like Prabhupada describes that, you know, someone who's on a spiritual path, or even not on a spiritual path, even in the middle of winter, they won't refrain from having a cold morning bath because it's their duty to do that. Or in the summer, you know, the woman or the lady in the house won't refrain from cooking because it's a duty. Or it's just like looking after children. You know, sometimes, you know, anyone who's got children can know that sometimes it's quite difficult or it's quite troublesome to care for children. But because it's our duty, we do it. Or in relationships, sometimes, you know, husband-wife relationship can be quite troublesome. But we don't give it up because it's our duty. To pursue, to persist, and to work cooperatively to, you know, for spiritual advancement. So we see that Vedic culture, duty is a very, very important thing. And it's actually, we see, especially with one who's cultivated for medical consciousness, you'll see that duty is a very important part of medical consciousness. Because why? Because it's actually a symptom of Bodhi goodness. One acts out of duty. Not whether they want to or not, or whether they like it or not. But you see, like in this material world, especially people who are interested in sense gratification, what is their prime motive? Whenever they do anything, what's the prime motive? Because it feels good, it tastes good, it smells good. It's all based on the senses. And you see that. There's a nice verse in the second chapter of Gita. Krishna explains to Arjuna, he says, Makta Svasa Tvampaya Siddhosa Sukha Vibhata Agamadhyana Nishtamsa Tikshvasa Paramata. He said, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress are just like the appearance and disappearance of some of the diseases. It arises from sensory perception. And this is the whole motive in this material world, is everyone is motivated by their senses. Whatever feels good to them or smells good to them, or they think they're going to get a good, you know, experience from it, they do it. But Krishna is saying to Arjuna, he says, you tolerate these things. You know, it may not be nice to you, or it may not be pleasing for you, but you tolerate these things. Because why? Because it is your duty, your chakra, you have to fight. Arjuna was trying to resist the idea of fighting because it wasn't pleasing to him to kill his relatives, especially his grandfather who was, you know, dearer to him than his own life, and his martial guru. He was being instructed by Krishna, he was put in a situation where he had to kill these persons, and that wasn't pleasing to him. But then Krishna pointed out to Arjuna that your duty as a kshatriya is to fight. Otherwise, you not only will you bring about your own ruination, you'll bring about the ruination of generations to come because you haven't followed your duty. And we see what's happening in this world now is that people do not act out of duty. Therefore, those who are in the dependence also following their path. And we see, you know, whatever acts, you know, a great man does, a common man will follow. And whatever standards he sets by exactly acts, all will pursue. So we see, like, the leaders, because they're not acting properly, therefore the citizens don't act properly. I mean, it's so common, you know, I mean, anyone who follows the news, it's so common where you hear that someone who's in a big position acts badly. You know, I mean, all the time. But there's a big, I haven't read it all much about it, but I know there's a controversy going on right now. It's in the news, and every single news article you see has got something to do with it. There's this movie star, and he slapped another person in the face, like, you know, in public on global television. Right? So this has become a thing now, that, you know, because this person's seen as being, you know, a leader of society. I mean, you know, actors, I mean, really the leaders of society. I mean, you know, they're just portraying illusion. But you know, now that, you know, actors and sports stars are the big people. They're the ones who pay all the money. And they're the leaders of society. And so whatever they do, whatever standards they set by their acts, then everyone's going to follow that. And we see, you know, if a movie star or some sort of fashion icon wears a particular type of clothes, then we see that all the young men and women are dressing the same. Same hairdo, same sunglasses, same, you know. I remember a few years ago, I was in London, and I noticed that all the girls were wearing pants with rips in them, like they had north and east torn out and things like that. And apparently it was because some famous singer had done the thing, so they were all following her. So it's like, I remember when I was a child, the Beatles, like, you know, it's like, you know, I grew up short back and sides, that was it, just like a military haircut, and everyone in my age group did the same thing. And when the Beatles became popular, that all went out the window. We all started to have long hair because, you know, they were the most popular people in the world at the time. And so whatever they did, and these other, you know, rock and roll groups and stuff, because they were the famous people, then we all followed. There was no kind of, like, you know, discrimination. It's just because they did it, we're going to do it. You know? And so this is how things happen in this world, how we find that trends come along, you know, that they have these things on the internet called influencers, you know, people who are, you know, like, I think on Instagram, there's some people who've got, you know, like, many millions of followers. You know, I mean, I don't sort of do social media very much, and I just find it such a drain of energy, but we use social media in the deity industry to promote the deity worship. But we see that there are people on social media who have millions upon millions of followers. And that they become what they call influencers, because what they do, people follow. They'll put up a post about something and everyone comments on the post, they like the post, all this sort of stuff. So they become influencers. But actually, in spiritual life, we're meant to become influencers. But the way you influence, the way you're meant to influence, is by exemplary acts, not by degraded acts. And we see that, you know, in this day and age, it's very common that those people who are influencers are actually influencing people to abominable behavior or irreligious behavior. But then we see here Daksha, because of he understood his duty. I think Jimena Lillamoki was talking about this yesterday, how he actually understood Dharma, he understood what his Dharma was. But because he was a Karmi, a Prabhupada, elaborates it very clearly in one of the Latin purports of this chapter, that Daksha was a Karmi. His whole motive was to improve himself, you know, improve his situation, to expand his dynasty. Yeah? And therefore he had 10, you know, he was a great personality, there's no doubt about this. And we can see in the Bhagavatam and the Vedic literatures, there's descriptions of so many persons there who had opportunities that we hanker for. They, you know, like Daksha, he got direct darshan of this supreme personality of Godhead. But what did he ask for? What did he ask when he saw Krishna? What was his goal? He wants sexual prowess. He wants to be able to, you know, because his duty was, his service was to be a progenitor. So he just took that, okay, this is what I need, and this is what I need to Krishna. I need the blessing so I can be a very, very effective progenitor. Which in one sense is okay, but it's not the ultimate goal of life. And this is where Dutch was missing the point. He didn't really catch the point of what was the ultimate goal of life. He was more interested in doing his material duty rather than actually pursuing the ultimate goal of life, which is to become Krishna conscious. And we see, there's a really nice verse, I think it's in the 11th canto. Devaki Buddhakam Vinam Krikinam Nakikiro Nayam Rini Chara Jan Sabatana. What's the name of the verse? This talks about, and we see later on that Daksha will make the same point when he's chastising Narada after Narada preaches the Salavashas that they renounce. He's saying that they haven't fulfilled their debts. They've got three debts, you know, for the spiritual master, the saint person, I think the spiritual master, saint person, and to their father. They haven't fulfilled those obligations. But we see in the Bhagavatam, this is Karbhajana Muni is speaking this verse in the 11th canto, where he says that, you know, for one who's taking the practice of devotional service, for one who's surrendered to the Supreme Person of Guru, Godhead, and they're on the path, it's called, who's on this path of bhakti, they don't have any debt. They don't have these material debts. You know, because this is something that's often misunderstood, is the difference between spiritual life and material life. Even we see, you know, it's quite common. Our son has a yoga studio in Brisbane, and we see, you know, like he's very clear. He's not in illusion about, you know, spiritual life, material life, or you know, yoga being, you know, whatever. But we see that many of the people, the practitioners who come and take up yoga, they feel that they're doing some spiritual process. But it's just gymnastics. It's just, you know, how to make the body healthy. It's got nothing to do with spiritual practice at all. But if they actually understand the point of yoga, what the word yoga actually means, is yukta, means to connect. And who do you connect with? Do you connect with your inner self? Do you connect with your body? No, you connect with Krishna. So they understand what the purpose of yoga is. And this is what he tries to do in his yoga practice. He has kirtan nights when he does his teacher training. One of the big things he has in his teacher training is Bhagavad Gita. He trains them in the principles of Bhagavad Gita. So actually their yoga becomes a transcendental journey rather than just learning how to have a healthy body. And ultimately, you know, we see why do we want to help the body, so we enjoy themselves more, we increase sex life, etc., etc. You know, so we see that, you know, basically, you know, materialistic people, they put a materialistic slam on everything, and they feel that the goal of life is to, you know, have a happy and peaceful life, or to have a prosperous life. This is what they want. Not that their focus is to understand the goal of life. Is to take shelter of the Supreme Person of Godhead and eventually go back home back to Godhead. So Daksha's, you know, he's had this opportunity. It's been, you know, the Supreme Person of Godhead has come before him directly and spoken to him and you know, given him blessings. And what does he ask for? You know? Give me sexual prowess so that I can procreate. He could have asked Krishna for pure and only devotional service, but that wasn't his interest. And we see there's so many examples of this. There's even one story that Prabhupada tells, you know, there's this woman who was walking around, she picked up this bundle of sticks. You see them, especially in Vrindavan side of India, they have these massive big bundles on their heads, you know, sticks and things like that. And then, you know, so she was walking along and then this big wind came and blew some of the sticks off her head. And you know, because she, you know, like, usually you see when they have these big bundles on their head, they don't get there on their own. Is someone picks them up and helps them get it on their head. You know? And so anyway, so the six blew off and she's saying, oh, I'm going to pick these up. And she's calling out, oh, Krishna, please come, please help me. And so she was calling out so sincerely that Krishna appeared. And when Krishna appeared, what did she ask for? Oh, now you come, please bless me with pure devotional service. What would you ask for, Mary? Would you ask for pure devotional service? Yeah. You hope so, yeah. But she asked for Krishna to pick up the sticks. And that's what we see the materialistic person do, is they're praying. They're praying for Krishna, some material benediction. But we see that Mahabhuisi is just asking, he says, he's saying, I don't want these things, I don't want this material benediction. I just want your forces of power and emotional service, birth after birth. Because Mahabhuisi, he's giving us this instruction so we can understand what is the goal of life, what is the purpose of our life. What is the purpose of human form of life? The purpose of human form of life, and Prahlada actually points this out in the seventh canto, is Homam Aja Praga, Nahum Bhagavad, Gurubam Mansamana, Tarapiya Gurubam. But from the tender age of childhood, Homam, which means 5 years old, one should practice the activities of devotional service. Give up all these other things, because ultimately they're ephemeral, they're temporary, they're ultimately useless. It cannot help you. At the moment of death, it does not matter how much wealth you have. It does not matter how beautiful your wife is or how handsome your husband is. It doesn't matter how wonderful your children are. At the moment of death, the only thing that can help you is Krishna consciousness. The only thing that can help you is your relationship with Krishna. This is really the whole focus of the Bhagavatam. You'll see there's so many wonderful stories that are being told here in the Bhagavatam. This story here is demonstrating how Daksha was missing the point. It was also demonstrating how Narada Muni fully understood the point of him before God. Therefore, he's coming and he's speaking to the Haryashras. They accept Narada as their spiritual master. They practice renunciation. They follow the path of Paramahamsa. And the Savalashras, you'll see, they follow the same path. They're following the path of their elder brothers because they see that Narada Muni, he preaches it like that. Your elder brothers did it, you should do it too. Narada Muni is always looking for this opportunity to present Krishna consciousness to people. There's so many wonderful stories of how Narada Muni comes and he's presenting Krishna consciousness. And even we see later on that Daksha, he was so upset when the Shamalashras decided to renounce, but Narada Muni thought, oh, this is a good opportunity. Now they're upset, I'll go and present Krishna consciousness to him. But Daksha didn't respond in a good way. He got quite upset and actually cursed Narada Muni, which he saw as a good thing. He saw this as a prayer. I don't mind. It just gives me more opportunity to preach. And so, quite a wonderful story. And so they might become victims of Narada's instructions. According to the Vedic culture, one should be trained in spiritual understanding as a brahmachari before entering household life to beget children. There's that nice verse from the beginning of the sixth chapter, Tapasya brahmachari yena samena chadamena chakena satsasota yamena yamena ba. That it talks about how one should engage in tapasya, practice austerities as a brahmachari. To control the mind, to control the senses. Very, very important. And we see here that Daksha, he's understanding that this is a really important part because of one's cultural growth. Because in Brahmacharya, you learn to control the senses. So first off, one practices celibacy. And then also, another, which is really good for one's spiritual growth. And Prabhupada makes the point repeatedly that without celibacy, one cannot advance in spiritual life. Because this is a big obstacle, a big stumbling block in spiritual life. And this is why we see in this modern society how people struggle with spiritual life, because one of the things they have to do is to give up sex life, or give up illicit sex. And, it's like, there's a story where Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's disciples, they went and preached one of his Lord Bhakti or something like that. No, the Bhakti's the second it was. And he was asking them, can you make me a Brahmana? Because he didn't want to be a Brahmana. And they said, of course, no problem. And you just have to follow some simple rules and you can do it. And they said, and they asked, the Bhakti's gentleman asked what were the rules, and they said, no eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. You know what his response was? Highly. Impossible to do this. And that's what it's like in this world. You ask people to follow these very principles, they say, this is impossible, no one can do this. And why would you not do this? Because how are you going to enjoy life without these things? That's their understanding, is how can you enjoy life without these things? Because the whole materialistic life is based on these principles, these pillars of irreligiosity. Without these things, they can't find peace, they can't find happiness, at least in their minds. But actually we find, if you step back and you look at these things, you'll see that these things are actually the cause of their disturbance, the cause of their unpeaceful minds, is because they're constantly engaged in trying to satisfy the mind and senses through these means, and actually achieve no peace. This is the situation for everyone in this world. They don't achieve peace because they don't know how, they don't know where to look. And so, practicing brahmacharya is a very, very important part of one's cultural evolution. But also, there's another important part about brahmacharya, is when this is described, I forgot the name, maybe you know where it is called, in Desh, it describes that, later on in the Bhagavatam, from memory, that when one is a brahmacharya, then they serve the spiritual master. And it mentions how, when the spiritual master gives instructions to the brahmacharya just says, yes, sir. There's no negotiation, there's no, well, I don't really like this, I don't like that. For brahmacharya, it's just, yes, sir. So, this is really important because it helps one to control the mind. It's just like, you look, for instance, when people join the army, and when they're in the army, they have this training, which sometimes, at least to us, might seem quite mindless. Why are they forcing them to do these things? They have to go on these marches where they've got a heavy backpack full of rocks and stuff like that, and they march for kilometer after kilometer. Sometimes they have to jog or run or whatever, And they really push them. They really push them hard. And if they disobey or if they sack off, there's discipline. But the whole point there is that, this is in peacetime where they really push them hard, but when they have to condition them to following orders. Because if they're in the thick of battle, when things get difficult, and if they can't follow orders, then how will the soldier be successful in war? So it's the same for us in devotional service, that, when things are easy, we need to be strictly regulated in terms of following the rules and regulations of the process of sadhana. Because sometimes it happens that things get difficult. The mind and senses push. And when the mind and senses start to push us, it becomes very difficult to control the mind, to control the senses, to focus on Krishna. But if we are habituated to this, if it's our daily practice, then when these things come, it's of no concern. It's like there's this analogy is given in one of the songs of Lord Jandas Thakur, where it's like, it's water off a lotus leaf. If you walk around, there's a big lake there, and if you walk around the lake, you get up towards the back, and there's a smaller lake, and there's lotuses growing in that lake. And so you can see in the rain what happens, like the lotus leaf is kind of a little bit shaped like that, round and shaped like that, so it's like a cup. And then when it rains, the water just, it falls in there, and it gets to the point where there's a critical mass. There's so much water, it's too much for it to stand the hole, so it just goes like that, and it dumps all the water out. And you'll notice that the leaf's completely dry. So, if we can become habituated to controlling our senses, controlling our mind, then when the material desires come, or when there's stimulation for the senses, you just dismiss it as unimportant. Which it is unimportant. And that's why brahmacharya is very, very important, to help control the mind and senses. through regulation through following the instructions of the Guru. This is the Vedic system. Thus, Prajapati Daksha sent his second group of sons for cultural improvement. I thought that was a really interesting term, cultural improvement. Despite the risk that because of the instructions of Narada, they might become as intelligent as their old brothers. So this is Prabhupada's making this is quite an interesting point. They might become as intelligent. So it seems to me that he's indicating like what Daksha's instruction was to some intelligent. But following the instructions of Narada, this is very intelligent. As a dutiful father, he did not hesitate to allow his sons to receive cultural instructions concerning the perfection of life. He depended upon them to choose whether to return home back to Godhead or to rot in this material world in various species of life. Pretty strong statements. In all circumstances, the duty of the father is to give cultural education to his sons, who must later decide which way to go. Responsible fathers should not hinder their sons who are making cultural advancement in association with the Krishna conscious movement. This is not a father's duty. The duty of a father is to give his son complete freedom to make his choice after becoming spiritually advanced by following the instructions of the spiritual master. So many important points that Srila Prabhupada is making here in this purport. And there's a few others I just want to touch on. One of the points that Prabhupada's making here is that he talks about this cultural improvement. Because as we understand, in this age, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura's point is closer to Sambhavan, that this age everyone's born a sutra or less. So, it's important for us to engage in this cultural improvement. Because we see, if you look at the nature of sutras, is their business really is just to follow the guidance of the orders of others and to be directed, especially by the Brahmins, but also by the Kshatriyas and Vaishnavas. So in this age, this cultural improvement is very, very important. And this is why the International Society of the Krishna Consciousness is so important. Srila Prabhupada said this movement is meant for cultural re-spiritualization of humanity at large, because it's the culture, the way people act with each other, the way they socially interact, the way they view the world. This is our culture. In this one age, as I was saying before, people view the world with a view to how can I enjoy the world. But actually, the proper understanding is this world is Krishna's energy. Krishna says in the Gita, that everything emanates from me. All spiritual material energy, it all comes from me. And so a wise person, as I mentioned, Buddha, one who's intelligent, Baba, who's intelligent, so they'll worship me also in this way. So, the real business of the kingdom of life is to develop one's understanding of the reality of my situation, who I am, which is the beginning question of Bhagavad Gita, and what is my duty? And this is what the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna's teaching on Jyotirindra, you are an eternal servant of Krishna, and your duty is to serve Krishna. So this is for all of us, it's the same thing. So this idea of cultural education or cultural re-spiritualization, we need to understand what is the purpose of life. And Daksha wasn't giving that to his sons. He was telling the purpose of life was to procreate. But I mean, it's like Rishabh Dev says, this kind of enjoyment is available to the whole dogs which you stool. They all do this. So what's the advantage of that? But no, the human form of life, as Palamara points out, is meant for Dharma. It's meant for understanding who you are and what is your purpose. And without understanding that, as I was saying the other day, Hippodesh references, without understanding that, you know better than that. So this is not what human life is about. And then, so he talks about this cultural spiritualization, but also the whole point of making decisions is we actually have to make our own decisions in life. It's like, and even when we come to spiritual life, to say to Krishna consciousness, sometimes we see that devotees will follow their authorities blindly. Of course we follow authorities, there's no doubt of that, but we should follow authority with intelligence, try to understand why it is that we're being directed in a particular way. Srila Prabhupada said that he wanted his disciples to be independently thoughtful. Like, okay, the instructions are there in the Bhagavatam. We read these instructions, but the idea is to understand why it is that we're being instructed in this way. It's just like, if you take a medicine, right, say, you've got a health regime, you need to follow, you take a medicine for a particular diet. If you understand, for instance, that, okay, you may have some illness which is potentially could become cancerous. Right? So the doctor says, don't eat sugar, don't do this, like this. If you just, don't understand, then sometimes you might eat sugar, whatever like that. But if you understand the nature of sugar, especially white sugar, how it feeds cancer cells, and you have this propensity to develop cancer, then you've got to say, okay, now I understand why the doctor's saying this, I'm not going to do it. And you just make firm resolve, and you can see, okay, I'm going to do this. So the idea is not to become blind followers. He denounced this idea of blind following. The idea is to follow intelligently. Understand that, yes, the guru is giving instruction. If I follow this instruction, it will help me in this way. But also I need to be understanding more about these instructions, to study more deeply how this can help me, how this can benefit me. Because sometimes what you see in spiritual life, particularly I've seen this in this one, how like someone will surrender the guru and then want to hand over all their responsibility to the guru. Right, so I'll just do whatever the guru says, but in reality it's not, they don't really do it. And then what happens is like, the guru will give some instruction which doesn't work out for them because they're unable to follow it properly, and they blame the guru. But actually, the point that's being made here is that one has to voluntarily follow these things and take responsibility for your life, because ultimately, as it's to use a common phrase, is we have to fly our own plane. You'll see that in the story of Dhruva Maharaj. When Dhruva went back home to Godhead, because he saw his mother as his guru. When Dhruva went back home to Godhead, when the Vaikuntha airplane came to take back home to Godhead, he asked the Vishnudas, what about my mother? And they indicated that she was flying on another plane. And Prabhupada in the purport there, he clearly points out how in spiritual life we need to take our own responsibility. We need to take responsibility for our spiritual management and not expect that someone else is going to do it for us. And it's a really important point. It's like, you hear about sometimes with the Mayavadis, particularly one in West Bengal, Ramakrishna. With his disciple Vivekananda, there's a description there how he touched his head and he felt this like bolt of electricity and he passed out, and the guru passed out, and when they came to him, he realized, what a little hogwash. It doesn't work like that, It just doesn't work like that. Someone touches your head and you become spiritually, realized. It just doesn't work like that. No, you have to endeavor on the path of bhakti. You have to purify yourself. Of course, Krishna can do it if he wants to, but it's unusual. It's quite weird. There is a description how when Dhruva was meditating, he touched Dhruva with his lotus flower, the conch. He touched him with the conch, and then he became spiritually surcharged. That's the nature of Krishna. But in the spiritual practice, generally we have to work very diligently to achieve success. So there are really many important points. And Prabhupada making the point that it's the duty of the father to give the instructions, but it's the choice of the son to follow or not follow, how to apply those instructions in their life. And then, and also the point that Prabhupada's making is that they're at the end of the purport is about becoming spiritually advanced by following the instructions of the spiritual master. The instructions of the spiritual master are very powerful. And we see on these prayers, Guru Bandha and Guru Vashtika, how to make the the words that Urubukapata Vakya and Vakya, the words Chitete, Chitete means the heart. To make the word Chitete Kodya Akya, how we need to make the instructions of spiritual master one with our heart. So it means like when the Guru gives instruction, you know, we follow. But we don't follow blindly, we understand how, you know, and if you don't understand, then ask. Oh, Guru Maharaj, you instructed me to do this, why? You know, can I understand, you know, how this is going to help me? You know, of course we have this part of Krishna's area, we have this submissive nature. You know, we ask, you know, how this will help me or whatever, but you know, it's really important that we follow with intelligence, follow with understanding. And if you do anything with proper understanding, there's a really interesting verse in the 10th canto. I can't remember exactly what it is. Neither do I remember the exact verse. But Krishna explains to... Actually, I think it's in the Govardhan Lila, where Krishna's explaining to Nanda Maharaj. He says that people who follow things without understanding the purpose, they will not get the benefit. But people who follow follow the Vedic structures, understanding the purpose, they'll get the benefit. So it's really important you understand, okay, this is the spiritual process, but, you know, and these instructions of the Shastra, these instructions of the Guru, but we need to understand what is the purpose, how this helps them to evolve, not we just like blindly follow. You'll definitely get benefit because the process is so powerful, but if you inquire submissively from the Guru, if you inquire submissively from the spiritual authorities, you will understand this process more deeply and it will be more effective. Just like anything, you know, if you do anything with knowledge, it's going to be more effective. So it's a very important point. And then, so I thought that was a really interesting point there. And then, there's a few verses I wanted to just reference here. And this is from the 5th canto, chapter 5, verses 16, 17, 18. Due to ignorance, the materialistic person does not know anything about his real self-interest. So we see here, Daksha is bewildered about self-interest. He's thinking that his self-interest is appropriate. He's thinking it's the same for his son. But he doesn't actually understand that the real self-interest, the auspicious path in life, is to become God-conscious. He's simply bound to material enjoyment by lusty desires, and all his plans are made for this purpose. That's exactly what's going on in this world. All the plans you see in this material world are just made for the purpose of trying to increase our enjoyment. For temporary sense gratification, such a person creates a society of envy, and due to this mentality, he plunges into the ocean of suffering. Such a foolish person does not even know about this. If you look at this world, what's going on? It's just a place of envy. People are making so many plans, but the ultimate result is they're suffering, and they're not even aware of it. They're not even, they're suffering. They're so deeply immersed in the suffering, they're not even aware of it. If someone is ignorant and addicted to the path of samsara, how can one who is actually learned, merciful, and advanced in spiritual knowledge engage in improving activity and thus further entangle him in material existence? If a blind man is walking down the wrong path, how can a gentleman allow him to continue on his way to danger? How can he approve this method? No wise or kind man can allow this. So we see this, like this first verse, in my mind, is talking about someone like Daksha. He's just thinking that, you know, just, you know, all I need to do is just improve my standard of enjoyment and I'll become happy. My sons will become happy. My dynasty will become happy, etc. And then the second verse we see, this is talking about Narayana. Because he's a gentleman, he's a wise man, and he's seeing, you know, if they follow this path, they're just going to be immersed in this ocean of worldly desires and suffering. And therefore he's saying, look, you know, the only path for them to follow, and they're very qualified people, so the only path for them to follow is the path of bhakti. So therefore he instructs them, the same as he did with the Hayashas. And the last verse, one who cannot deliver his dependents from the path of repeated birth and death should never become a spiritual master, a father, a husband, a mother, or a worshipper of the demigod. So this is the duty of when one becomes a father, a mother, you know, a guru, anything like that. When one takes any position of leadership anywhere, then their duty is to deliver that person from the path of birth and death. And that's why, you know, we're all extremely extremely fortunate to have come into contact with this Krishna conscious movement, because that's the purpose of this Krishna conscious movement, is to deliver people from the path of repeated birth and death, and deliver people back to those who are Krishna. That's the purpose. There's no other purpose behind it. And so, if we understand this purpose, like you see, people come to ISKCON, and sometimes they have different motives. And Krishna points this out in Gita, the four types of motives that people have. You know, distress, seeking wealth, one who's inquisitive, one who's searching up as well as the absolute. But one that, you know, even though one may have a different motive, if one actually understands the purpose of ISKCON, or the purpose of spiritual life, then ultimately they will achieve that more rapidly, more quickly. But if you don't understand, it can take lifetimes. So, very important for us to understand what is the purpose of this Krishna conscious movement. It's not about, you know, welfare activities, it's not about, you know, I mean, why do we distribute prasadam? It's a good example. Why do we distribute prasadam? To feed hungry people? But nothing to do with that at all. That they may be hungry, so therefore there's a good opportunity for preaching. We distribute prasadam to connect people with Krishna, because Krishna prasadam is not different from Krishna. When they eat Krishna prasadam, they come into contact with Krishna. Why do we chant the whole day in the streets? Because we like singing? No, it's because we're giving the whole day to people. And by chanting Krishna's whole day, then the Lord is dancing all the time. So, you know, all these activities, this is like Prabhupada would call it a missionary organization. But the whole mission is to give people Krishna. Understand that when they come into contact with Krishna, this will, you know, can bring about the end of their inauspicious life, and all of them will turn back on, back to Godhead. I finished there. Any questions at all? Yeah.
Just on the last point you mentioned regarding feeding the hungry.
Yeah.
I remember reading recently in the 7th canto, Prahlad Maharaj highlights the 30 qualities of the human, the qualities that one should acquire in human life. And one of those qualities is actually equal distribution of food to all living entities.
Yeah, this is Narada Muni talking
here.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And
the last four chapters talk about Vanashram.
Yes, it's in that section. And then there, I think in the end of those qualities, it is mentioned that just by doing those activities, or by developing those qualities, Krishna is pleased.
Yeah.
So actually, even if you would have this motive to feed the hungry, it would still please Krishna, right?
Yeah.
Because he said, oh, we don't do it to feed the hungry. Do
yeah, but even like you look at those, like Narada Muni says that these are human qualities, these are basic human qualities. Without these, you're not a human being. It's not even talking about spiritual life, it's just talking about human qualities.
Yeah.
But then the devotee, you take these same things and connect them to Krishna, yeah, and then give people, not just give them food, but give them Krishna in the form of food, or give them Krishna in the form of a book, or give them Krishna in the form of the whole name. Or give them Krishna in the form of your association. And that's why it's really important that we also need to become transcendentalists. We also need to manifest this saintly behavior. Because when people come into contact with devotees who are manifesting saintly behavior, they themselves will also become saintly. So, you know, there's, for the members of the Krishna conscious movement, there's a big responsibility, a great responsibility to give Krishna consciousness, but also just the way, you know, just like, you know, if you see someone, you know, who's preaching a particular way, you know, they're talking about no meaning. I remember when I first came in contact with devotees, that one of the people who introduced me to Krishna consciousness, he was talking to me about Krishna consciousness, but he himself wasn't following. So it was a bit hypocritical. And in one sense, I didn't sort of take it as enthusiastically or as seriously as I might have, because I was seeing discrepancies in his practice, which sort of reminded me so much of my upbringing. Because when I was, you know, a child, my father was, you know, really keen that we would become Christians and stuff like that, and he would push us to church and Sunday school and this kind of stuff. But then I saw a lot of discrepancies in his practice and the practice of others. So there's a big responsibility on us is to develop this idea of behavior and become Shrestha. Shrestha is the best of the human beings. So, you know, it's important for us to develop this kind of, you know, mentality and become the best of human beings. Yes? When are you going to come and give class? Okay? All these nice questions. What's your question today?
So he's saying that Daksha's duty was to create progeny, but isn't his duty to design the progeny and the previous sons that's wrong?
So even though he had desire to create progeny, he what?
You said that his duty is to create progeny, but isn't the duty to design for progeny and then give his son the throne of the entire process? But he didn't have the desire, so like, how is it his duty?
Yeah, initially they had the desire because their father instructed them. You know, so they just want, because, see, one of the things that's being pointed out here in this verse, at least I feel being pointed out here in this verse, is how important duty is. You know, when the father instructs the sons out of duty, as good sons, they follow the father. The father out of duty wants to see that the sons achieve perfection in life. He had a different idea of perfection. Like, his idea of perfection was to have a big family. But, you know, Narad Muni came and instructed them, actually, no, this is not perfection of life. And that's why we see, if you go back into the verses earlier on, how he says to them, you know, at the end of his instructions to the Haryashas, he said, actually, you're not following the instructions of your father. Yeah. But he's indicating that Shastra is your father, not Prajapati Daksha. Does that answer your question?
Thank you for a nice lecture. I had a question about the progeny. I think the Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said that he would make hundreds of children when he would be able to deliver them.
Yeah.
So how does it work? Because if such a saying person says he cannot even deliver his children, if he would make children, how can others think like that? And also on the other side, I think his sons of Daksha are actually perfect beings, then they could actually make their children also.
Yeah.
They could also perfect Daksha. How does it work?
Well, I guess we can look at it in different ways. I mean, you know, as with the instructions of sainted persons and the Supreme Lord, there's many layers to it. It's not just like a simple, straightforward instruction. We can understand many things from it. So one point, several points I can get from this. One thing is that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is pointing out how great a responsibility it is and actually how difficult it is in this age is to bring people to the point of Krishna consciousness. So that's one thing I see there. Another thing I see in that is also, in his humble way, he's just saying, no, I don't want to waste time on stuff like that. You know, I just want to present Krishna consciousness. Yeah, and that was his determination, was just to give Krishna consciousness to others. So, yeah. Bob, do you have any other questions on that?
Yeah,
it's just like, you know, he's probably not wanting to discourage you, his three master disciples, you know. And I'm not saying to them, like, waste the time, because they would want to take up renunciation, but it would be artificial renunciation because they're not ready for it. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the duties of the guru, is yes, the guru preaches renunciation, the guru preaches, you know, elevated Krishna consciousness, but also the guru needs to ensure that they're preaching, there's a particular word, a particular phrase, that's a common phrase these days, but like mission appropriate or like, you know, appropriate to the audience, you know, audience appropriate instructions. So like, you know, if someone's caught up in Grihastha life and they're just not ready to announce it, you have to kind of, again, it really depends on how saintly or how elevated the preacher is. But you don't want to push people to artificial renunciation, because what will happen is they'll renounce, but because they haven't actually given up the desire, because they haven't given up the attachment, they'll go back there at some point. So he's preaching to his Grihastha disciples, and if he says to them, oh yeah, you know, Grihastha life is a waste of time, it's just a well, you know, a dark, ignorant well, then they'll say, oh, Guru Maharaj wants us to renounce. So they'll renounce the artificial renunciation, which will actually be detrimental for them in the long term, because then they'll take the path of renunciation, they'll give up the ashram. You know, there's a sannyasa, which is usually a big mistake. You know, very, very, you know. wrong thing to do. So Ben at once says, you know, and it's the same with the story of, I think it was called Brahmana, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was traveling around India, and he was down in Kumbhakshetra, and he met that Brahmana there. And the Brahmana was like looking at the lifestyle of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and you know, I want to live like this, and I want to travel and be a sannyasi, isn't it? And then Mahaprabhu said, no, just stay where you are, say, Yadav Nekitara Kana Krishna Videsh. But wherever you are, whoever you meet, you preach Krishna to them. You don't have to take up the line of renunciation if that is not your calling, if that is not your situation. You know, we have to practice Krishna consciousness according to our capacity, and then advance from there. Not that we all become sannyasis, because frankly speaking, probably none of us, most of us, would be able to survive as sannyasi. Would be able to live as sannyasi because we're attached. Some different things. So, yes, Bro. I hope you understood me today. I was trying to speak a little bit slower, but sometimes you're excited.
Thank you. The devotional life is much more tougher than the military life. Because you mentioned the training for the war, and the devotional life, the training is totally different. It's a purity of mind, purity of consciousness. And our devotion to the God should also accept what he studies, what is in our mind.
Yeah.
So which is better, I mean, which is more tougher actually.
Yeah. But devotional life essentially just means connecting everything with Krishna. Seeing the connection, not just like connecting, but seeing how everything is actually connected to Krishna. This is real renunciation. And this is what Krishna is speaking to Arjuna in the sixth chapter of Gita. This is real renunciation, to see, not to go to the forest and live like a mendicant. Real renunciation means, this is called yukta-vairagya-vairagya-sutra. This is real renunciation, is when you see this sambandha. You see how everything is actually connected to Krishna. That's spiritual life. Because that means then that you have no proprietorship. That means that you're trying to overlord and you're trying to control. Because you see that everything belongs to Krishna. And my business is to serve him, because, you know, and use these things. Because, you know, if you understand that everything belongs to Krishna, just like, you know, if you understand you work for a wealthy man, you understand everything belongs to a wealthy man, you use these things to serve the wealthy man. You don't use these things for your own sexual education. And it's the same situation here. If we understand that everything belongs to Krishna, and it's to be used in his service, then we're actually Krishna conscious. This is the topmost yogi. And as Krishna says in here, not he who lights on the fire. Yeah? That's not the topmost yogi. The topmost yogi is he who uses everything to serve Krishna. We use it to serve Krishna, we become liberated. We use it to serve ourselves, we become found out. Okay. Thank you all very much for the Prabhupada Ki. Sama Metta Bhakti Vrinda Ki. Jai Nitai Vopremanandi.